Have you ever stopped to think how something like global demand for tea could actually spark wars and, totally reshape history?
It's amazing, isn't it? These seemingly simple things, everyday commodities, they can become these huge flashpoints.
Right, pushing nations into conflicts that just echo for ages.
Exactly.
And that's kind of the fascinating area we're digging into today on the Deep Dive. We're going to unpack the powerful economic stuff and the political ideas driving the first and second opium wars in China.
Yeah, those were roughly 1839 to 42, and then again 56 to 60.
And our mission here is to take the sources you shared, the excerpts from the Opium Wars, trade, imperialism, and Chinese resistance, and really boil them down for you, give you the key insights, a shortcut to getting a solid handle on this really pivotal time.
We'll trace it all back, from that massive demand for tea, bizarrely, to the whole illicit opium trade that kind of popped up as a quote-unquote solution.
And look at the consequences, which were huge, often tragic for China and its relationship with the West.
Yeah, and there are some genuinely surprising details in there we'll uncover.
Okay, so to really get how this whole thing blew up, we first need to understand China's viewpoint, right? The Qing dynasty's initial take on foreign trade.
Which was pretty unique. They basically limited it almost entirely to one port, Canton. And frankly, they didn't see much need for European stuff.
So the emperor saw it more like tribute, like he was used to people bringing him gifts.
Pretty much. The
Okay.
trade wasn't seen as this equal exchange. And outsiders, well, they call them barbarian.
Barbarians, yeah, it does a lot.
Direct contact was a big no-no. All business had to funnel through these specific licensed local merchants, the Hong merchants.
And the rules for the traders themselves were super strict, weren't they? No bringing families, no speaking Chinese. They had to use this simplified pidgin language.
Exactly. I mean, imagine trying to do business like that. It was incredibly restrictive.
Which must have driven the Westerners, especially the British, crazy.
Oh, absolutely. Because back in the West, particularly Britain, demand for Chinese goods was just skyrocketing. Tea, silk, porcelain.
Especially tea, you mentioned. That was becoming huge.
Huge. It wasn't just a drink. Its popularity was actually replacing alcohol in workplaces. Some sources say it was boosting productivity.
Wow. So tea literally fueled the workforce.
Right.
But this created a massive trade imbalance then. China didn't want Western goods, so Britain was just pouring silver out.
Precisely. It was a huge drain. Economically, it just wasn't sustainable for Britain. They were desperate to sell something to China.
So they tried diplomacy first, right? I remember reading about Lord Macartney's mission.
That was 1793. Yeah, he went over, officially for the emperor's birthday, bringing
But
gifts.
it didn't go well.
Not at all. His gifts were seen as kind of unimpressive, outdated even. He was basically dismissed. A real snub.
And that wasn't the only time, was it? Another attempt later on.
1816, yeah. Also rejected.
So after being shut down like that multiple times.
Well, it seems the British government started to think maybe force is the only language they'll understand, the only way to really open things up.
Okay, so that frustration, that economic pressure, it leads them to opium.
It does. Opium becomes the answer they were looking for, though a devastating one.
So Western traders, Brits, but Americans too, they find just immense profits in selling opium to China.
It becomes the number one trade item. Think about that. A drug.
And it's basically how they start paying for all that tea and silk, even though it's totally illegal, smuggled in.
Right. The scale of the British involvement, particularly, was enormous. After they took control in India, especially around Patna,
That's where they grew it.
they set up huge cultivation operations, employed local Bengalis to process it into these sort of round balls of raw opium, stored them in warehouses.
And the British East India Company was shipping thousands of chests of this stuff.
Thousands every year. A massive state-backed drug operation, essentially.
But it wasn't just the British, you said. Americans were in on it too.
Oh, yeah. Companies like Russell Sturgis and Co. They found their niche trading opium they sourced from Turkey, shipping it to China.
And they even helped the British smugglers in Canton, like liaisons.
That's what the sources suggest, helping coordinate the illegal trade. It was quite the international effort, sadly.
And the smuggling itself. Fast crabs and scrambling dragons. Those sound like something out of a story.
There are types of boats, yeah. Small, fast watercraft designed to zip through the canals and deliver the drugs quickly, avoiding patrols. It paints a picture, doesn't it? This kind of frantic underground network.
It really does. But while the foreigners were making fortunes, China was facing a massive crisis.
A devastating one. Opium wasn't totally new. It had been banned way back in 1729, but the use just exploded.
2 million addicts at its peak. That's staggering for the time.
Staggering. By the early 1800s, peaking around 1839, it had seeped into so many levels of society. The price dropped, making it accessible even beyond the elite. It was hitting middle-class families hard.
And the sources mention this chilling detail that the Western elites involved, British and American, just didn't see themselves as responsible.
Yeah, a total disconnect. We just sell it. What happens next isn't our problem. That kind of attitude, apparently.
So how did the Chinese leadership react? The Emperor Daogong couldn't just ignore this, surely.
No, they definitely couldn't. By 1839, the situation was dire. So the emperor called in a special official, Commissioner Lin Zexu.
Okay, Commissioner Lin. What was he like? What was his plan?
Lin was known as a really honorable guy. He hated the corruption tied to the opium trade, hated what it was doing to the country. His mission was crystal clear: stop the trade, seize the drugs, destroy them.
And he meant business.
Absolutely. He moved fast, intercepted and confiscated a huge amount, over 21,000 chests of opium.
Wow. And then he actually destroyed it.
Huh? Yeah, he mixed it with lime and salt, dissolved it, and had it all flushed out into the sea.
And there's that weird detail about him warning the sea creatures.
Ah, yes. Telling the fish and crabs to beware. A symbolic gesture, maybe, but it shows his determination. He also cracked down hard, executed some merchants involved.
And he tried diplomacy again? Wrote to Queen Victoria?
He did. Wrote two letters, apparently appealing to her conscience, asking her to stop the trade. But they never reached her. One was flat out refused by the British government.
So Lin's crackdown was a huge move against the trade, a victory for China in a way.
But the British saw it completely differently. They saw it as destruction of their property, a direct attack on their interests.
They did not intend to let that go, as the source says.
Exactly. Lin's actions, however justified from China's perspective, became the trigger. The excuse the British needed, or wanted, to use force and fundamentally change the trade relationship.
Right, so this directly leads to the First Opium War. The British send in the warships.
A really formidable fleet for the time. They had a technological edge, definitely, including this newfangled steam-powered warship, the Nemesis.
Nemesis sounds ominous. And the Chinese military just couldn't compete.
Not really. The British ships had better guns, better maneuverability. They started capturing key coastal cities. The fighting went on for about 3 years.
3 years. And in the end,
British military superiority won out. They gained the upper hand decisively.
And once they had the upper hand, they made demands. Payback for the opium Lin destroyed.
Right. Compensation for their lost drug money. And crucially, they demanded more access, more ports open for trade.
Which led to the Treaty of Nanjing, the first of the unfair treaties, as they became known.
Deeply unfair. The terms were dictated by the victors, really.
What were the key points? China had to pay millions.
Millions in silver, yes, to Britain for the destroyed opium and war costs. They were forced to open four more ports: Fuzhou, Ningbo, Shanghai, and Xiamen, besides Canton.
And maybe the most damaging part, the British living there weren't subject to Chinese law.
But that's extraterritoriality.
Yeah.
British subjects in these treaty ports would be tried under British law by British courts. A huge infringement on Chinese sovereignty. It basically created little pockets of foreign territory within China.
So a massive win for the Western powers, opening up China by force.
Highly beneficial for them, yes.
Yeah.
Secured the markets they wanted.
But the sources emphasize the long-term cost for China. Decades of native hostility toward foreigners. It created deep resentment.
Understandably so. It marked the start of what China calls the Century of Humiliation, a period of being dominated by foreign powers, stemming directly from this conflict over trade and, well, drugs.
So this deep dive really shows how something like the demand for tea could spiral, couldn't it, into economic dependency, then an imperialistic drug trade, cultural clashes, and finally, war.
It's a stark example how commercial interests that drive for profit can escalate and just redraw the global map with consequences that linger for generations. The clash between China's desire for isolation and Western, particularly British, ambition and military power.
Absolutely. And it makes you think, doesn't it, about how those historical power imbalances, the kind we saw play out so dramatically in the Opium Wars, might still be shaping international relations and perceptions today.
That legacy of trade, empire, coercion. How does it continue to influence national identity, foreign policy, even now? It's definitely something worth mulling over long after this deep dive ends.